Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We are a network of tech founders, investors and connectors, and our aim is to support startups on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this since 2003. We're active across Australia. We've got over 5,000 members. So if you're interested in joining us, please check us out and sign up as a member at innovationbay.com. Now, if you like this podcast, and we really hope you do, please do tell the world about us on social media. And if you're feeling super generous, you could also rate us wherever you listen to your podcast. We love hearing your feedback, so please do let us know how we're doing and who else you might like to hear on the show. On today's podcast, we have David Walsh. Now, David shouldn't be confused with Tasmania's David Walsh of the sort of gambling tycoon fame and fortune who's built Museum of Modern Art. This is the other David Walsh. He's an awesome guy. I met him back in 2013, actually, in a cycling bunch. He was working for someone else, just moved to Sydney from Ireland. I loved him from the moment I met him. He was really tenacious and hungry, and he's built this amazing business. It's called CIM. It used to be called CIM Enviro, and it's all about helping buildings and other generally property assets become more efficient in their energy usage, so saving time and, I guess, making the planet greener and healthier. So I love what he's doing. He's built a great business now. I think it's 40 plus staff, really solid turnover. He's a member of the Innovation Bay Summit Club for Series A and Beyond founders. So he's really active and great with that club. Yeah, so he's making a difference. He's built an incredible team. So we get into some of the details as to, you know, secret for great hiring. Just a story of true resilience. Yeah, I really enjoyed this one, and he's a great guy. So enjoy the chat I had with Dave. All right, welcome to the show once more. I am in Sydney, actually in his hotel room, which is a first. So thanks for the invite to the hotel room. I'm with David Walsh. David is a fantastic Irish entrepreneur who's now in Aussie, I think, and he runs CIM Enviro. So welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Ian.
Yeah. Now, you don't actually live in Sydney anymore. Where are you?
Live up in Byron.
Right. So why did you move up there?
It was a bit of a...
You happy?
No, not yet. No, look, it's an awesome place, and thanks for having me as well for this podcast.
No problem. But you've got a fascinating business. I mean, I've known you for a long time now, all the way back from, I think, even before you started the business. So it's been a fascinating journey. I think I met you on the bicycle, if I remember. So that was good. Dave's a pretty good cyclist. So anyway, let's talk about the business first, and then maybe backtrack to hear a bit more about you. So yeah, tell us about CIM. Like, what does it do, and what problem are you solving?
Yeah, thanks. So what we've done at CIM is build a SaaS platform called the Peak Platform that helps
PEAK.
Yeah, Peak Platform that helps the people that operate large, complex buildings to run them more efficiently. And what that does is it delivers just incredible economic and very, very importantly, environmental outcomes.
Right. And so, this is what, like supermarkets, office buildings?
Yeah. So we do about 58% of all the premium A-grade shopping centers in Australia. So we do...
Say that again,
58%.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah. So we do all of the likes of QIC, Queensland Investment Corporation. We do all of Mervac Retail, do most of Centre Group.
Westfield?
Yeah, Westfield. Yeah, Centre Group here in Australia. And then overseas, we've gotten into industry and manufacturing. So we work with Johnson & Johnson, Dell, Dupuy, who make Ypsilanti. And the same process works really well. The ability to help these people kind of solve the problems that exist on the sites with around, like, it's really, really challenging when there's legacy systems on a large building to identify, kind of get a uniform and transparent view of the data. Then the next thing is there's lots of vendors. Like, there's different people engaged in different ways on the site. So by the nature of their contract, they may and may not actually have the answer to a problem when the problem occurs. And then the problems that occur are, you know, equipment breaking down and, in the case of an office building, we do tons of office buildings as well. A tenant or a person, everybody's worked in an office that has either been too hot or too cold.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible experience, right? And for productivity, ignoring the environmental wastage when, you know, you have electricity running too hard to power a chiller, or in the UK, you have gas to make a place warmer, to make an office warmer. Like, having it too hot or too cold, that it actually affects the productivity while wasting emissions and stuff. It's just an incredibly inefficient way of running assets.
And I mean, just maybe a little more deep dive into it. I mean, how does the system work? So is it software that sits inside the building control center that just tells the switches and the air conditioners when to go on and off?
Yeah, look, what we've done is, the key for me building the business was, I mean, I did computer science. I got into the built environment, into buildings, and I just really saw that the data that was flowing around the building was not being used. The way people were approaching the problem was to put on additional hardware, to put on, let's say, electricity submeters onto the incoming mains on electricity. So that involves shutting down a building at the weekend, like mounting hardware onto the circuit boards at the bottom of a building and turning it back on and essentially monitoring a spike on a graph. And I just couldn't believe it, right? I was like, why don't we just go into the building and capture all the data that the pumps, the fans, the foot traffic, the temperature data, all the movement information in the building, all the moving parts, right? Because that's where the problem is. And at the time, the company I was working with said, no, you can't do that. And this is 9 years ago. And I said, hang on, is it not possible to do it? Or does this company not do it? And they said, well, we don't do it. So like 9 years ago, I knew there was just a better mousetrap in all of this.
And all the sensors and, the telemetrics or whatever you'd call it, they were in place and they still are in place.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not having to go in and sort of backfit any of this stuff?
No. So my research was all around how to quickly acquire and normalize data from multiple different types of assets. So it took us 3.5 years to do that, to be able to put, like, we're a software company, we're a SaaS-based platform, right? So we only installed one, essentially a data acquisition device. And you said telemetry, right? It sits there and listens. But what we've been very, very good doing was the ability to listen to any form of traffic. So at the moment, we take 600 million data points every month, and they are a complete MRI scan of every single building here in Australia and now in Europe. And we can, once we take all those 600 million points, we've then built an incredibly high resolution rules based platform to identify within those 600 million points which data point is telling us something.
Yeah.
Which data point is telling us that there's wasted energy? Which one is telling us that a tenant is too hot or too cold? Which one is telling us that, you know, an $800,000 piece of equipment is about to fail? Which one, when with these data points, when you get this information, you can then see what is and isn't being maintained correctly. So not only can you kind of completely reduce all energy wastage, and you're talking like 15, 20, 30% on large complex assets, you can then also take the next step and you can deliver what's called data-driven maintenance. Because the process for maintaining large assets, it's archaic. It's a laminated tick sheet process where people are walking around an asset. And once every 6 weeks or once every 6 months, they go and visually inspect a piece of equipment. But the biggest waste with all of this is checking things that actually work, right? What's the point in sending a maintenance technician to something to check it when the data is showing that it works?
Yeah.
Why not just go to the things that are not working and replace those? Because that's where the wins are, right?
So in terms of these wins, like, so the principal benefit that a customer has using the CIM system is money saving. Is that right?
Yep.
Right.
But it has many, many layers to it, right? In the sense of the tip of the iceberg is that, like, we get the kind of trust of a client with kind of that speed to value. So like in 3 or 4 weeks, we're able to bring on, with one of our clients, we brought on 13 large shopping centers in 5 weeks onto the platform.
Right.
So that speed to value is very, very important because, you know, people are so used to now with tech, the ability to kind of turn something on and have a new lens to, you know, do their accounts or have a productivity tool within a business. So for me, it was very, very important that you could move really quickly, because in buildings and in industry, sometimes things take months, if not years, to get projects rolled out. And I just thought that model was crazy. So the first thing they get is that kind of energy saving. Then after that, it's a case of how do we improve the whole supply chain that operates within that asset? How do we do genuine data-driven maintenance? How do we, you know, you can take 90% off certain types of contracts when you do that. Like building management system maintenance contracts, you can reduce them by 90%. Like air conditioning maintenance, you can reduce it by 55%.
Yeah.
And then the next phase, when you gather, like, let's say 18, 24 months of this data, you can then do a thing called improved capital management, which means that if you have, let's say, a shopping center that has 120 chillers, each of which can cost, you know, $500,000, $600,000, $800,000 just to buy the equipment, not even just to install it. You then have the ability to identify, bang for the buck, which piece of equipment you should replace in order to kind of move the business closer to their net zero emission target, right? Whereas previously you were going to a consultant, and the consultant was doing a visual inspection of the equipment and saying, okay, well, this big piece of equipment is 11 years old, you replace it.
Yeah.
But that piece of equipment might only be used for three weeks of the year, and when it does perform, it actually might perform pretty well. And then you're wasting your capital.
Yeah.
And now in a COVID world where capital has always been tight, but now they're just, everyone's cutting back on their capital expenditure or CapEx. The ability to have, you know, high resolution, granular information on what equipment should and shouldn't be maintained. Sorry, what equipment should and shouldn't be replaced is hugely valuable.
Yeah. I mean, I want to jump to the COVID stuff in a sec, but I mean, there is a sort of macro view here. I mean, if every building in the world was installed with software like this, then the planet's energy usage would plummet. Is that right?
Well, look, I mean, this is the reason why I'm able to get such good people into the business, and why, you know, if people say it, if the why is important enough, then people will go through any kind of how to get there. And the why for us is this emissions, right? Like, everybody is missing a trick with their approach to improving emissions and then reducing emissions, because there's nothing wrong with solar panels. There's nothing wrong with geothermal. There's nothing wrong with wind. But to make all of those things, you're using aluminium, steel, concrete. And they take a lot of embodied energy just to make.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have large assets, airports, shopping centers, commercial buildings, casinos, and just through inefficiencies within systems, they're wasting like 10, 15, 20, you know, 30% of the energy at the source.
Yeah.
So the very first fuel that people should be looking at, you know, is energy efficiency.
Yeah.
And software is just a great way to, you know, to identify these issues and to help people collaborate, to work better, to fix them.
And in terms of how you charge for this, like, so what does a customer typically engage with, and how much they roughly are they paying?
Yeah, look, it has to be, for me, again, in this industry, it was very little. It was all upfront capital and then fees. So we came to the market with the traditional SaaS model, which is free to install and then a monthly fee.
Right.
Now, you know, I mean, again, because we don't install any hardware, only one acquisition device, it means that then opens up, puts all of the, let's say, the risk, if property owners or, you know, industry, like the large companies that I mentioned, if they are unsure about a solution like this, it means that, you know, there's very little risk.
Yeah.
And what happens with the tech as well is the average, what we term it to be a payback period, or even for the technology, be cash flow positive. It's 5.7 months before it's cash flow positive.
Right.
And in many cases, it's weeks before it's generating cash. So what happens with that, when that process happens, is you get a lot of trust with the client. And what we have is just really, really solid relationships with the people we deal with, because we're there. Like, we're independent from, we don't have a dog in the fight, in the sense of we're not looking to sell more equipment. We're not looking to get upgrades or maintenance contracts. We're essentially very much client side, And then we really are just helping direct the traffic to get the outcomes and improve the collaboration and get more from the existing contracts that they've already signed, right? Everybody has these things on these large sites, these challenges and these equipment breakdowns and unhappy tenants. So
And so where's the business at? Like, you know, I don't, you can put the metrics on it as you want, but you know, staff number is normally a good one, growth and longevity.
No, mate, look, so we're going 5 years. There's just under 40 people. I'm really fortunate to have such a really solid team with us. Like, we some really, 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 I did computer science. I was pretty average at computer science, but I was very good at getting computer scientists to work with me. So,
yeah. All right. Well, look, maybe we'll jump to you then, because I mean, it is a sort of interesting backstory how you, you know, decided to launch, become a founder and do this, and how, you know, you got here. So like, take us back, because you're obviously not from these parts. You sound maybe a little bit Irish. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. No, so I'm from a place called Templemore in Tipperary. Yeah, look, and I came to Australia as a backpacker 22 years ago. I was fortunate enough to get my permanent residency. Went back to Ireland, got involved in business.
So back, was it easy to get permanent residency back then?
Yeah.
You just ask? Is that Irish? Let me in.
No, look, it was good having the kind of computer science background.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I kind of got enough points.
So you were like a smart backpacker. You did some real jobs rather than laboring. And Right.
So went back to Ireland in 2003, 2004. Then, unfortunately, we were involved in business, property and construction. And Ireland took a degree of correction in 2008, 2009. So I ended up back in Australia with Linda, my wife, and Ellie and Anton, our kids, in March 2009, with like having lost everything. So we had $5,000, no schools, no apartment, no jobs. And I ended up collecting furniture from the side of the street in North Bondi, where we were living. And
oh, that North Bondi furniture, that's a cut above IKEA, isn't it? It's amazing what you find in the street in North Bondi.
No, look, it was like Bondi in that area, and Sydney and Australia in general, right, has been great to us. It is a great place to live, and the standard of living here is fantastic. And
so you got a job?
Yeah, I've got a job, had to start again.
What were you doing?
So look, when I landed, I had no real intention of being a founder. But I looked at, I wanted a sector that was, you know, that was defensible. And I knew that sustainability, energy efficiency and the macros around that, I knew property, like tenants were demanding kind of green leases and energy prices were rising. And I kind of thought with my background in computer science and then kind of property that at the time prop tech didn't exist, that word, but that's getting very popular now over the last 3 or 4 years. So I targeted the property sector and around energy efficiency, sustainability, and I ended up working for a company that did this electricity submetering. Right. And 1 week into that job, I kind of saw, look, there's a better mousetrap in this model. And I worked with that company. I had very little understanding of kind of mechanical or electrical or building services engineering. So I worked with that company for about 4 or 5 years and then started this.
Right. So what year was that?
So I started the business in 2015.
Yeah.
But look,
I'm sure you were talking to, you remember you and I having coffees back in, I don't know, it must be 13, because I kind of remember the cafes that I had based on my career trajectory. And it was down in Pyramid when I was at Vicorp. Yeah, and I just remember this crazy Irishman turning up and saying, hey, I'm going to start this business. I'm not good at accents. I'm not even going to try it. But yeah, I mean, the whole story was fascinating, because, like, you know, you had the founder mentality and I knew you wanted to do it, but you kind of, and I don't quite know how to put my finger on it, but you had a different approach to it or a different attitude to it. You didn't want to, you know, take funding. You didn't want to do it the traditional. You just did it the fucking hard way.
Yeah, look, I mean, the other side to it, Ian, is I'd never raised venture capital. I'd never done the pitch deck. I actually didn't believe that somebody should fund a business unless you have revenue and build something. So I definitely did it the hard way. And I think that probably has built up a lot of resilience, probably has had a, you know, made it harder than I needed to, like mental health wise. I put myself probably under, I gave a year and a half when I did start working at night in a factory. So every night I'd go 5:30, take off this, I'd go door to door during the day and selling the software inside in the city. And then 5:30 at night, I'd go out to a place called Toll that did essentially the post.
Yeah.
And from 5:30 to 10:30 every night for $38 an hour, I'd sort satchels and, you know, just I didn't have any venture funding.
Yeah.
And I needed 100% to do it right. And this is the thing with anybody like you, you know, to a startup needs 100% of your effort. Like it's like boiling water at 95 degrees. You just have warm water, right? So I just had to jump in and I had to do it. That's what I felt. And I had to build a product and get customers. So
yeah. So tell us about that first product.
Yeah, look, I mean, like every product, when you look back now, it's laughable. But at the time, it was way ahead, right?
But how did you build it?
Yeah, so what we did was the very first employee was Colin, who I went to uni with, Colin Cullinan.
Oh, yeah. He's still with you, isn't he?
Yeah. So Colin essentially built the first version of it. We were able to acquire data from these buildings. And Colin, you know, has an incredible background as well. And he came from system architecture into this. So he just said, okay, if I'm building a system, I want to make sure that it's built for 10,000 buildings from the start. And that's what we focused on. Like we didn't just build a dashboard and, you know, and kind of go out and market and raise funding. What we did is we knew with the type of challenge that we were facing that we'd have to come to market with a whole product and that may take years. But we also kept a very close eye on the competitor analysis and we saw, like we were all of the time pretty much ahead of the game. Obviously, there's lots of, like every business, there's now lots of new entrants into markets and stuff. But what we found is that with a business like this, even from the enterprise sales approach, like I wanted to get the business to $1 million in recurring revenue before I got any salespeople, because I just didn't think it was fair to say, hey, mate, here you go, sell this and get me $1 million in recurring revenue without proving it myself that I could do it. And then gradually built out the team and I was very kind of planned and strategic in what I did. Like I wanted to get the revenue to a certain point before I took on external funding. When I did get external funding, I wanted a certain type of funding. I took it from a research agency because I knew I needed access into it. This is a combination between, you know, data science and mechanical electrical engineering and then computer UI, UX product. So I knew I needed like access to more gray matter. So we took money from a research agency and that hooked us in with the large universities here in Australia. So people can do their master's and PhD programs through the business and continued on. And then the team, yeah, as I say, is just under 40 people now at the office in Europe. We're going super strong, coming into kind of profitability now, which is awesome. Being very light on.
So, I mean, but you did raise funding of sorts.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. So we did.
Tell us about that and how much and what
so
you
we
did,
raised
did with it.
$3 million from that research agency.
This was a few years ago now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. About 3 years ago. And then we raised $2.5 million directly from a superannuation fund who came to us. And
right.
So we like.
That's a small check for a super fund.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did they come about?
They said they had a mandate to invest in startups. They were
specifically in sort of this
sector. They were in it. They were hooked into this part of superannuation. They knew people, they knew clients, and the clients spoke quite highly of us.
Right.
And it is like, look, I mean, it was a small amount for a super fund, and it was unusual for it to be direct, but it has worked really well, and they've been good investors, and it allowed us to grow another bit. And again, like for me, this is bigger. Like this is why with the right investor for me really has to understand the size of the prize here. It's not like we're already changing how all of these buildings operate. So, you know, you get plenty of startups who say, I want to change the world. We're already changing the world. Now our vision is that every single building in the world should have this platform.
Yeah,
because like the environmental impact here is huge, absolutely huge. And then you have that element of software, which is hugely scalable, right? But the thing is, what I found is, yes, the environmental impact is huge, but you still have to deliver a good economic outcome for all of these people, because people, you know, they want to see a return on investment on every single issue that they're fixing. They want to be able to have a new lens to run the assets, and everyone is looking for new data sources and the ability to kind of do more with what they already have. And again, that's what we end up kind of bringing into these businesses. But we do it in a way that's kind of, it's a team sport, and we end up working in with them quite well, right?
I mean, this is a massive market. I mean, I don't know whether you talk about it as in, you know, absolute market size, but every building in the world using your software, I mean, how big a market size are we talking?
But like, real estate is the largest asset class in the world still, right? And that's just real estate. Now that we're kind of in industry and manufacturing, like that opens, that means you're not just in one sector, i.e. property and real estate. It means as we've kind of gotten into these large companies, they absolutely just love that ability to have to get visibility into these systems that they traditionally couldn't before, because.
And it seems like a no-brainer. Like if I'm a building owner, then surely I want to save a bunch of money and energy. It's the right thing to do. You know, it's going to help the environment. And it's, you know, if you're talking about a 6-month payback period, then you know, why is this so hard to sell?
Or yeah, no,
is it hard to sell?
No, look at it. Look, enterprise sales, I mean, I'm not a sales guy, right? But, you know, it's with the payback so quick. Like this is why I pursued the business, like because I could see something that I knew other people couldn't see, right? But then I was like, why it didn't take off immediately, I just couldn't work it out. And the real thing was because I had to master enterprise sales. So, and that's, you know, I don't know how much of that you've been involved in, but.
Yeah, enough. Yeah, enough. It's hard.
It's hard graft, right? And what you have to do is identify different personas within businesses and people that will champion your product internally. And the truth is, no matter how good your product is, you're not just competing with your competitors. You're actually also competing with other projects internally for that capital. Right. So you have to do all different types of things around competitor lockout documents. You got to work with people through tenders. You know, you have to do technical demonstrations really well and align to different personas, because enterprise sales, and we have, you know, we've plenty of people now paying us north of 50, 60 grand a month in recurring fees. And, you know, for us, one of the key KPIs of people that champion our product in, and typically we'll have 3 or 4 people that will really believe in the product and kind of embed it into the business. But one of the KPIs is that we must help that person or those people to like do everything to kind of evolve their careers within the organization. Yeah. Because, you know, people, you know, with the contracts we sign, they're not small contracts, because we have such an impact on businesses, right? Right way from, let's say, a fund manager's level all the way down to a facility manager, and even right the way down to like maintenance contractors. So it's disruption in a really positive way, but you must have the whole company aligned to that. Like we can't do a free to paying model with what we do, because the impact gets washed away, right? Yeah. People have to trust in the platform. Then once it gets in and it starts, we get our head under the bonnet.
So you said you're not an enterprise salesperson, but obviously you've had to learn.
Yeah, I am now.
You know, and look, but you're also, the other thing I know about you is you're data driven. So, I mean, I know within your software and, you know, the users and the way they interact with it, you know, measure every data point. And it's the same in enterprise sales. I mean, like you've got to measure data, and, you know, you talked about your renewal rates and your cost of acquisition and all those things. So how do you match up that data with, you know, give the audience maybe some tips about how to think about enterprise sales for a business like yours?
Look, enterprise sales, there's so many, like honestly, if you had 10 hours, I could talk to you about it, right? Because there's such an amount in
it. 36.
Look, at the highest level, to get somebody to pay you 50 grand a month, it takes hundreds, maybe even thousands of small interactions done really well, right? People are short on time. You have to identify the right personas within the business. You have to model out what that persona wants. So account-based marketing, not just enterprise sales, is incredibly important. But when you are working with these clients, you have to have some kind of a set process that you're taking them through, because otherwise it just takes forever. And you just can't afford that when you're a startup, right?
And what about the metrics of you as the employer of these salespeople? You know, so, you know, a good enterprise salesperson, I don't know, base of 120 to 150. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if they achieve the target, it's going to be more than that. I mean, how much do they need to sell? You know, just talk to us about that scaling process within.
Yeah, look, I mean, like ramping up salespeople is incredibly important. What we've found is that, you know, the best salespeople, and we have great people in the team now who aren't, we've tried getting, you know, just your traditional kind of stack them high and sell it cheap salespeople, and it just doesn't work, right? Yeah. Because we're talking to a very sophisticated audience. You need people who understand the pain points. So what we've done is we've gotten technical people and trained them up in sales. They do need it. Like, look, they do incredibly well with us, right? Because the way I stack up the commission structure, because we're built for growth. For me, I'm not trying to squeeze commissions and stuff. I'm trying to really pour money into their pocket with the more sales that they get. But it's very, very important that they are able to hit their metrics and they're able to get these large deals across the line, because you need to have the confidence to be able to talk to a very senior person in an organization. But then you also need to have the technical ability to understand what somebody, you know, on the ground, like in nuts and bolts, needs to do to fix all these problems. So we found it best to get like sophisticated, determined technical people and then train them up with the, you know, with all of the things you need to do.
Yeah.
Around, you know, continuously persuading people to get them to show them the benefit that you can deliver, right?
And excuse me, I mean, does it feel like you're heading towards a tipping point? I mean, it feels like your software is now at a point that it's really sophisticated. Customers are using it and loving it. You know, in theory, do you not just turn the dial up in the number of amazing enterprise salespeople you've got, and then, you know, you're a billion-dollar business?
Yeah. Look, I mean, the goal of it being a billion-dollar business is not that for me. Like, I mean, I want to create something that goes way beyond me, right? I mean, I could have sold the business 2 or 3 years ago and done really well, but that's not it, right? I mean, the impact that this can have, like, on the environment is too important to kind of just put them, let's be a unicorn or something like that. It doesn't, like, what I want to do is I want to just see how many buildings I can actually improve, and then how many now, as we move into industry, how much can I actually improve it?
But to have that impact, I mean, it's the same principle. To have that impact, you've got to turn the volume knob on the, you know, the process and the people, and just build your internal factory.
No, absolutely. Look, I mean, and we are, it does often feel, it's an interesting point that, like, the time to pour more capital into a business is where you just feel you're being restricted. Your growth has been restricted from that lack of, let's say, marketing or lack of sales.
And is that where you are now?
Yep. It very much feels like we're close on that. As I say, there's been 4 or 5 years gone into the base platform, the expertise and the level, like the European office was a big test in the sense that could we, you know, building that, one of the hardest things you can do is start a business. The next hardest thing is start the first remote office.
Yeah.
But thankfully we've gotten off to a great, great start there, hit the ground running, and it definitely feels like that.
Where's that? Where did you set that up?
Yeah, so I set it up in Ireland.
Right.
And then with Ireland with an office in London.
Right. And you sent one of your original staff members over to run it, didn't you?
No, so my older brother, Paul Walsh.
Ah, I knew there was a close linkage.
Paul is fantastic.
Because that's one of the challenges. Like, that remote office, yeah. It generally, if it's not one of the founders, it's pretty hard to make it work. So I guess, you know.
So I was blessed. Look, Paul is a mechanical engineer with an MBA, and he was the head of energy for Johnson & Johnson in Ireland. So it was coincidence that we kind of both got into this sector. He obviously was in another part of it in corporate. But look, he came in, and it was Paul's idea to go pursue manufacturing, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't have a background in that. And it has been fantastic, right? It really has. And what he's shown is there's a whole new sector. It's a lift and shift model.
Yeah.
But look, we are in a good, really good spot. I mean, I want to make sure as well that if I do take capital now, that I get an investor that really understands where we want to go with it, right? Because I don't, same way, it's very important for me with the people in the business that I really changed their lives in a positive way, right? That day when they're in the business, they become more experienced. And even we do a lot of physical training within the business. It's an option. And even we do kinesiology. We do different sets of things around improving people, like both like mentally and physically. So I want this to be their greatest job. But then it, with the right investor that's out there, I want to, like, I'm not too interested in pitching and people kind of arguing down the all the things that the business doesn't have. I want to make sure that someone's coming into the business and knows the size of the opportunity and is there to support us, like, not just this year, but in the following years, and have deep pockets, right? Yeah. Who just understands.
Well, let's dig into that a bit, because, I mean, one of the things that struck me all the way through is just how the high caliber of staff that you were able to bring on. I mean, you know, it's like every great founder I know can bring in great staff, but, you know, what struck me about you is that you actually did that kind of ahead of where I would have expected it. I mean, you had amazing people from Goldman, ex-Atlassian, and I mean, it was just, you know, your team is punching above its weight. How'd you do that?
Look, I think it's also a byproduct of not having much cash, right? I mean,
That's counterintuitive.
No, I disagree. I mean, if you don't have much money, then the only thing you have is your vision, right? Because you don't have much cash.
Yeah.
And you then have to convince people of your vision. And that's what I had to do, right? And the people that are in the business, like plenty of them, don't need to work anymore, right? But it goes back to that thing about the why we're doing it, right? And then I was telling these people, look, I haven't 100% figured out the how. Like, we need to acquire the data, we need to normalize it, we need to be able to visualize it across, you know, dozens and dozens of different assets. We need to be able to identify where the issues are occurring, and we then need to be able to create an awesome user experience so that the rectification can happen. But what you'll find is with good technical people that they don't want the beanbags and the ping pong tables, like, that fucking annoys them, right, in a lot of cases. What they're looking for is a good engineering problem where the size of the prize is big enough so that it's worth their while, right?
Yeah.
And that's like what I was able to do. As I said, look, we're trying to completely change property and real estate. And now we're trying to do the same thing within manufacturing and industrial. And for technical people, and when you show them the market and you say, look, there is no Atlassian, there is no Oracle or SAP in this sector, because no one has cracked it, right? And you say, this is our approach. It's scalable. It's software. We've already got a good team. And we've discussed this in the past, right? The key thing with it is the hiring is just the most important thing. Every problem is a people problem.
Yeah.
And you've said it a number of times to me in the past, like, A hires A, right?
Yeah.
And
A hires A plus.
Correct. Because they just don't feel that if a smarter person comes into the room, or if someone with different skill sets, they don't have a wafer thin self-esteem and a high ego. They're keen to learn from other people. So they will bring awesome other people in and then work with them, right, without clashing. Whereas someone that, you know, is essentially B grade, and you can kind of call B grade being, you know, aggressive or, you know, passive aggressive or narcissistic or any of those traits, they don't want someone smarter than them coming into an organization because they feel that person will show them up.
Yeah.
So A hires A or A plus, but B will hire C and C will hire D.
Yeah.
And where this falls out, if you're not a good founder, is 2 or 3 years down the road, like, the product doesn't work, or the clients aren't happy, or you're not getting the scale, and they're all trailing metrics at that stage because it's over, right?
Yeah.
So it's just so super important to kind of get the hiring right. And I was just fortunate to be able to.
Yeah. I guess it's the same question on how do you retain them? I mean, it's, you know, give them a good environment with a vision that they can align to.
I think the retention is another challenge as well, because you need to be able to, like, what's a founder's job, right? A founder's job is number one, you got to look after the people, right? And the cultural side of it. Like, if anything ever goes wrong culturally in a business, it's the founder's fault.
Yeah.
Like, all of these businesses that have problems, the fish rots from the head down, right? There's just no question that every single business that has the Enrons, you know what I mean?
You're full of these Irish proverbs, aren't you?
But it's true, right? I mean, you just gotta, the culture is the key, right? And Michael Porter's like strategy or culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah.
He said that 20 years ago. Like I saw that during the GFC and also again during COVID, right? Just how much when you have a good culture, let's say during the GFC, it was with Linda and myself, like that culture of get up and go again and, you know, don't look back. And we had some education behind us and a lot of drive. But even during COVID, like, you know, how we look at our target market, right? Our clients are shopping centers, airports, commercial buildings are all being really affected by COVID. But yet now we haven't just retained clients. We've had nearly almost doubled the revenue during COVID. So the first thing is culture. Then the next thing to retain.
So hang on, just back step. So you've doubled your revenue even despite your clients getting clobbered by COVID.
Mm.
Wow.
It's been like really, really humbling.
You must have been nervous back in March though.
Yeah.
Right.
It did bring out a lot of kind of previous battle scars.
Yeah.
But what I also learned is that you just can't control all of these externalities, right? The only thing you control is your own habits, right? Like, so I ride a bike with Ian. He's normally faster than me. But
normally.
But, you know, external things around people getting too worried about COVID. And I know an awful lot of people are obviously doing it hard. But controlling your own habits, right? How much sleep you get, how much alcohol you drink, what you eat, how much exercise you do, how much mindfulness and how much meditation. Like, they're the only things you can really control, right?
Yeah.
So I did definitely February, March, just it kind of felt like I was getting punched in the face every week for maybe 5 or 6 weeks. But then really just settled down to, okay, well, what's a really manageable, controllable strategy, which was like we quite simply developed a customer love channel inside in Slack in the business, got very much closer to our clients, irrespective to whether they were going to retain our technology. We just said, okay, we just got to get out there and help them. One of our board members helped me, Philip, with like essentially a strategy around giving our champions spears and shields to help them to, you know, because everyone in our customers' lives was doing it incredibly hard, right? They didn't know what's going to do. It's all about the culture internally. And then that culture permeates into the clients, right? When you have a business like ours. But to retain, go back to that question about retaining people, like the culture is the first thing. Then after that, it's setting a strategy that these incredibly experienced and smart people believe in.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but you alluded earlier to, you know, the struggles or, you know, the challenges you had in the early stages. You know, you had no cash, your product, it wasn't really popping. I mean, it was just, I know how hard it was for you. So when you came through to this year and as you said, February, March getting punched in the face, I mean, did you feel like a boxer that's like, yeah, well, this is nothing. So, you know, when are you really going to hit me? Did that early days help?
Look, I think you can only build up calluses and stuff by going through those hard times. I think when I went through a ton of stuff, obviously an economic migrant, right? Arriving here, you know, with no cash, having to rebuild. I think I've learned an awful lot, Ian, around the mental health stuff, like during this journey. I think the founder burnout thing is a huge problem. Like in our industry, I know dozens and dozens of founders and, you know, personally, I operated from a base of kind of anxiety and fear. I always went forward, right? So I'm incredibly driven.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from the background of endurance sports. But I always go forward. But I used to go forward with an awful lot of anxiety and kind of fear.
Yeah.
So like literally every Friday evening, like I would just be wiped out for the whole weekend and just come good like Sunday night and just get back into the city and go again. And kind of a lot of the breath work and mindfulness and different things that I've been kind of bringing into daily routine have meant that I feel these days that I'm able to like start the day with a certain level of energy and finish the day with even more energy.
Yeah.
So that feels awesome. That's something that I know if I miss that like alignment in my general life that I can't achieve that, right? And the alignment kind of, it ties in with the fact that this is a continuous paradox, what we do, right, with founders, whereby you're trying to, you know, walk across ice and convince everyone that it's solid ground, right? And, you know, it does take its toll mentally. I think the pain and the suffering element, like I, like lots of founders go through it. I certainly went through it. I think helping, it would be nice to have a group that, you know, around you that would maybe suggest some of the things that I've been fortunate enough to be able to learn, in particular through Linda, my wife, who's now a breathwork practitioner, which is great. So I think founders need that support to continue, but also I am my best self when I'm centered and aligned. Like if I'm anxious or fearful, you know, then it's very hard for, let's say, one of our sales team to come and have a chat, or the marketing team, or you can't, very hard to be creative when you're fearful. So,
I mean, you're part of the Innovation Based Summit Club, you know, and that's a group. We've now got 34, you know, members. They're all sort of Series A and beyond. We did a session yesterday. That's part of the reason you're in town. Look, but a bunch of the day was spent talking about, I mean, it didn't start specifically with this outcome, but we ended up talking about suffering and how suffering is actually a core part of the founder's journey. And in some ways, you can't have the high. I mean, it's almost a steady state for the founder, you know, that you can't have the highs or the outcomes without the suffering in advance. Any reflections on that or observations?
No, just a general point on that Summit Club. Like, it is really, and fair play to you. I mean, it's very well set up. Those sessions are very well run. I mean, it's very difficult now because lots of people yesterday were quite remote. And
it was kind of a weird hybrid. So we had most people in Sydney, but we had groups in Adelaide, Brisbane, Hobart, and then a bunch of other individuals who were either sick or remote generally. So it was hard.
Yeah. No, but again, I think, like everything, people are so well used to trying to just drive it on and get on with it now. They are fine with it. We're fine with the format, right? And when they see people are trying hard, there's not a lot more you can do. But no, the more, it's very important that, like, when you don't have a work, like, I'm a sole founder, so my board are great. But again, I don't tell them everything, you know, and equally, I don't want to bring all the stuff home to Linda.
The only people that understand the founder's journey are other founders.
Correct. 100%. And look, they can say the smallest things. Like in that summer club, like, you know, we've had these chats around OKRs and like really solid, like, management tips from others, right? Yeah. And then, you know, like, just you pick up tons and tons of other little things that none of it at the time is earth-shattering. But I mean, again, what it is, it's not like mental health or like anything. Like once you see somebody else, like it's each of it is a brick in an overall wall, right? Each thing or each action. So I think, you know, there's plenty of crying on each other's shoulders and talking about the different challenges. But that's also hugely important, right? And it's not easy to take a full day when things are so busy, right? And there's so much happening.
But, you know, it's also not just about the business. I mean, we make sure that we're focused on you as a person and the relationships you've got, you know, whether it's your family or your friends or whoever, you know, because that ultimately, you know, it's the balance. I mean, because if one of those three things is out of whack, so if you're kids are sick or you got to look after your parents, the other two factors suffer.
Yeah, man.
So, you know, it's like a bar stool, like three legs, if they're all solid, it doesn't move. But two legs, falls over. Four legs, will wobble.
Yeah. No, look, you're 100%. Like, I don't know how far many more legs the bar stool could have had on. I don't know.
I think we can get to five, it starts being stable again. So the analogy is a little stretched.
But no, look, I mean, you're right. I mean, this is the thing, right, is that this is an infinite game. And being a founder, like any founder that comes to a VC or to me or to anyone saying, oh, this is how I'm going to sell it for and yada yada, just literally walk away, because it's not about that, right? Good businesses aren't sold, they're bought. So build up a good business and it you know, everything, that's the hard stuff, right, is building it up. But even the hard stuff is staying aligned and balanced, because the bigger the company gets, if I'm walking around the office or meeting people, and, you know, my mind is somewhere else and I'm not coming, like the energy that's from me is either worried or aggressive. People pick that up, right? So they can't be their best selves.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, you're doing stuff to make yourself perform optimally and be balanced. And I have two beautiful kids as well, right? I don't want to be aggressive towards them, or I don't want to be completely tired all the time. And, you know, they're 16 now, nearly 16 and 14. So like they're going to be 5 years time, you know, they'll be out of the house.
Yeah.
I don't want them to have memories of an angry founder. You know what I mean? And then, so like, it's an infinite game and you attract, like when you like attracts like, right? I mean, you're only, and if you're walking around the place or if you're, let's say, on the grog every night and culturally, you know, the wrong things permeate into the business, I believe, if you're not set up to kind of go forever. And I just don't know, with that founder burnout and operating from a place of fear and anxiety, that you can do that, right?
Yeah. All right, well, let's try and finish in a more positive note. Like, so, I mean, a bunch of people listening out there, like, what can we do to help? I mean, are you looking for customers? You're looking for cash? You're looking for team members?
Well, look, I mean, always looking for team members, right? Like, people, the beauty about what we do is, like, software and even go to market, marketing, like salespeople, mechanical or electrical engineers, like, this is a, you know, this is a problem worth solving, right? This is a problem worth dropping anchor on and giving it, I've given it whatever, nearly 6 years of my life. And I really, you know, I can't wait for the next 6 years of it. So employees are people to join the team 100%. And if there is anyone listening, just, you know, send something like Ian. Sure, we can
don't
put
send
in.
It to me. Send it to you. Like, what's your email?
Yeah. I'll put it in. I'm surely we'll add something to the notes, will we? But yeah, always open to people that are looking to for a new challenge.
What's the website?
CIM.io.
Right.
So,
because you did have a different name.
We dropped the Enviro out of it, so it's just CIM. Just thought and put in .io.
Yeah.
To be cool. That's what we just started marketing 12 months ago, and the marketing team came in and said, that's not cool. Put this in, this is cooler.
It was quite long.
Yeah, no, the name went from CIM Environmental Group to CIM Enviro.
Right.
Now just CIM.
All right.
So like, in relation to kind of investors and stuff, I'm still not good with pitching for cash, right? I don't do it. So I tend to end up getting too technical. I probably need pitching lessons or something like that. But like, what I'd rather do is build a business that has like the absolute perfect metrics. And then, you know, like, I don't, if anyone gets involved in this business, I want it to be the very best investment they do ever.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not trying to build something small, right? So it has to be somebody that gets what we're trying to do. I'm a sole founder, so I'll be open with the support that I need. I've learned an awful lot, but the worst thing you can, the battle cry of the fool is someone who says they know everything. So, you know, I want people that I can learn from and have scars on their back and also have knowledge and wisdom. It's one thing just to have knowledge, right? Because the wisdom is also the key thing. If you look at the people that the famous your founders in the US had, their best board members tend to be the people who had fantastic knowledge around how to get the best out of them, like sports coaches. It's someone that can kind of help us like that, versus just, I can get cash anywhere really for, you know, just looking for cash.
All right. Dave, thank you. That was a great insight. I always learned something. I know a lot more about you and the business once more. So, should we jump to the quick fire round?
Go for it. Yeah.
All right. So, can you give us a book recommendation?
Michael Singer. The Untethered Soul has been very good. It's all about the ability to kind of surrender into hard things and kind of disconnect yourself from the voices in the head. I found that great recently.
Yeah.
Definitely recommend that. There's plenty of business ones, but everyone. Crossing the Chasm is a great business book.
Yeah.
It's a really good one.
All right. Let's move on. Podcast. Do you listen to podcasts?
Yeah, Rich Roll. I'm getting right into Rich Roll, who was...
Is that his name?
Yeah.
Right.
American guy, swimmer, became a lawyer, then became a pretty chronic alcoholic and hit really rock bottom, and then got back into endurance sports. So I can see where he was coming. He did ultra marathons. He has typically got good stuff, and we had one with, I think, Andrew Huberman, who's a neuroscientist. Again, another interesting story. This Andrew guy was a skater and from a broken family, but like, again, ended up in really rough situations and went back and kind of studied and became a PhD neuroscientist. And there was a recent podcast with that as well that was really insightful, right? All the stuff that they were talking about.
That's great. News source, like, what do you lean on to get your news?
Facebook.
No, you don't.
No, I don't. I don't even have. I think they're still chasing me because they have one user. I know one other person that doesn't have a Facebook account. But no, look, maybe that I pay for likes of the Times and the UK Times.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know you live in Australia?
I do.
Yeah, you should maybe.
Have you read the Australian newspapers?
Yeah, the AFR is pretty good.
No, look, the AFR, I do. I've subscribed to AFR.
All right, there you go. Why didn't you give that as your answer?
No, I do. I'm a good friend.
You need some prodding.
Yeah, no.
No, there are some great people there. I really love the writing. So, Paul Smith's been on the show, as is Yolanda, in fact, in one of our news podcasts, and great, great people.
No, look, and they are great as well for startup community too.
Yeah, I agree.
They've been a help along the way.
Yeah, so everyone subscribe to the AFR.
Do.
That's a free ad for them.
Yeah.
All right, productivity tool. What do you use to stay productive, efficient?
As a software tool, I think Slack has been great, but has the potential to be.
Becomes the next total, email.
Yeah, nuisance. And I think this interruption kind of society, I don't turn on my Slack notifications.
Right.
Because getting nothing done. But I think Slack, if you use it correctly, is good. I just, productivity in general, productivity tools for management, OKRs and stuff, are something that I probably spent too long. Sorry, I didn't implement soon enough.
Right.
And now that I'm kind of trying, like we're going through a stage of implementing, that's, I think it's a really good structure for, it's hard being a founder, right? And just driving forward. I've had to learn again management skills and stuff. I say learn again. I never had them in the first place. So now I've just had to learn management skills and OKRs and kind of setting up that professional development for people is super important around productivity because then just people have a clear view.
Do you have a favorite app on your phone? You're allowed to choose a boring one, but you could also choose a cool one.
No, nothing as cool. Instagram, really, for like the family's photographs and stuff. But even at that,
you know, that's owned by Facebook.
I do.
Checking. Yeah, you know that.
And yeah, but look, Slack on the phone is good as well as kind of, I'm trying to kind of remove as much things that distract me off the phone. So I'm gradually trying to get rid of a fair few of those apps. Like Instagram is good, but I end up, unnecessarily, it's full of like stuff around bike riding, cycling, Tour de France,
right?
So it kind of it soaks up unnecessary time. Yeah. I'm trying to read more books.
Yeah, read more is good. Yeah. But you know, do you use your phone for that? Like, you have a Kindle now?
No, I have a Kindle, but never really.
So hard copy.
Yeah, and I do, like, I'm trying to get through at least a book a month now, right? So
yeah, that's good.
You know what I mean? I mean, a lot of the
best founders read a lot.
Yeah, they read, and you can see why, because it's just constant course correction or even what you pour into the subconscious, like better things come out. Like, yeah. So,
Who is your favorite tech CEO?
Mate, look, I can't really. I think Mike Cannon Brookes, you know, like I'd go as far as even to say I have a bit of like CEO crush on him in the sense that.
Apparently, he's a listener, so he might get this far in it. So,
I'm sure he's Mike. But I think I like that calling it as it is, right? I mean, not enough people just call it as it is.
Yeah.
Call out the government, call out people for doing things wrong. And it's probably reflective of the amount that they own of that business. Like, they're not under any pressure. Like, I'm the majority shareholder in this business. I have a great board that supports me to support the business. But like, maybe it's just like, you're Scottish, I'm Irish. Like, I mean, I don't suffer fools gladly, and I'm not really into sugarcoating it. I don't want a bored career. You know, if something's wrong, if we're doing the wrong thing, just call it out, right?
Yeah.
We can't. So the way he calls stuff out, I love it.
Yeah, right? That's great. Do you watch TV?
There's not. Like the SBS, like on demand, I watch a bit of it. But no, I'd be much more into kind of, and it's into when YouTube, even when you start looking at kind of mindfulness stuff. Like it feeds you whatever you're looking at. So
its algorithm is pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, it knows what you want. And then last question. So if the TED organizers phoned you and said, hey, we want you to do a TED talk, what would you talk about?
I mean, I'd have to talk about just the trick that everyone's missing around energy efficiency, right?
Yeah.
It's insane. Like, to give you an idea, someone I know really well put up a wind turbine in a manufacturing plant, right? And it's one of the massive wind turbines in Europe. And that wind turbine took 16 cement trucks full of concrete for the foundation. And like that, the embodied energy in concrete. So in relation to emissions, like you have China, US, then concrete.
Is that right?
Emissions. Yeah, yeah. So like that 16 full trucks, like that's going to, if that wind turbine turns for like, I don't know, whatever, 10 years, it might just offset the amount of emissions in the foundation. Whereas going in and like being able to reduce it at source, like in the externalities that has up to the grid, let's say, like the poles and wires, which are trees are going into the poles and wires, and it's decaying, it's getting more inefficient. So definitely that kind of data-driven energy efficiency stuff is just not at all getting enough attention.
Well, the good news is when Ted does phone you about that, you can just send him that 90-second clip.
Yeah, that'll work.
All right, look, we're out of time. Dave, that was awesome.
No,
thank you.
Gunner.
Thanks for being on it. No. Like, come on, we'll go do a fist pump.
Yeah, no, I was going to shake his hand and he was a fist pump. You're dead.
Yeah, all right.
See ya. Good man. Thanks, Ian.